great to be back in Utrecht with friends and family. I'll try to speak for about an hour, so we have plenty of time for questions, discussion. Can you hear me okay back there? The theme I chose this year was no self in Zen Buddhism. One of the, perhaps the most central notion of Buddhism, that there is no eternal, unchanging, substantial self or self-substance. Not just with human beings, but in anything, anywhere. Buddhism asserts that there is no such thing. The Sanskrit term for those interested is anatma, or Pali anatta, in Japanese muga, literally no ego or no self, without ego, without self. Looking at no self from the outside as a peculiar idea or concept, it might seem bizarre, self-contradictory, ridiculous. Seen from the outside, perhaps that's inevitable. It's interesting to see how different people who look at it from the outside come to different conclusions about what this no-self supposedly is. Some people find it rather frightening, threatening. It's taking away their most precious, commodity. So some people find it rather frightening or threatening, needless to say, because they don't really understand it from the inside. Other people look at it as extremely cold and sterile and lifeless, dead. There's no self, there's no life. Again, of course, this results from a complete misunderstanding of what no self actually is. We can view no self, look at no self from the outside. People have written whole books about it, philosophically, psychologically, linguistically, and otherwise. And you can read those books if you wish. But what I would like to do tonight with you is to go inside no self so that you can see clearly what it really is. Talking. It's really nothing so strange or mysterious at all, unless we keep ourselves apart from it. To the extent that we really enter into it, it becomes obvious. You see how from the outside we can't even begin. From the outside, well, if there's no self, who's talking now? Who's listening? Who's going to realize no self? All these questions sound very interesting. And are, of course, completely unanswerable without the experience of no self. Once you realize no self, it becomes self-evident. There's nothing more obvious in the world. Looking at it from the outside, we can waste our lifetime trying to do that. So once again, let us very simply, directly, and gently look at this truth from the inside. In English, we have a word, seesaw. It's a children's playground toy. What do you call it in Dutch? Zip? A zip? Zip ball? Yeah, it's the same as in English, seesaw. I think most of us as children enjoyed riding up and down on it and maybe even standing in the middle. One very simple way of explaining what Buddhism is all about, and also what no self is all about, is to see how our life is, in a sense, like a seesaw. In other words, we are riding, constantly riding the seesaw, going up and down, you might ask what these extremes are. Well, actually, anything will do, but let's just use some very simple, concrete examples. Let's say this extreme is the experience of real boredom or ennui, right? Real boredom, tedious boredom, ennui. And the other end of the seesaw might be extreme stress or anxiety or frustration. And what we do in our ordinary life, of course, is we're kind of bouncing back and forth between those two. Again, this is just one example. We could use anything, but I think these are helpful. Boredom and anxiety or stress. We're actually going back and forth and back and forth. So, for example, when we're at work or in our family life and we're experiencing a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress, we naturally, instinctively almost seek to escape, to, as we say, get away from it all. Maybe we're not sick, but we call in sick, say we can't go to work. Maybe we even have the luxury of spending some days resting up, right? So from the state of extreme stress and anxiety where things are too much, we seek to go this way. And maybe for a short period of time, we really enjoy it. Sleep as late as we want, turn off the alarm clock, read the newspaper, or watch TV, listen to music. But we all know what happens after a couple of days, don't we? It starts to become boring. And so we start seeking for some kind of excitement, stimulus. And so back and forth on the seesaw of samsara is the technical term. The endless dis-ease is how I translate the first noble truths of Buddhism. Often it's translated as suffering, but that's a very one-sided negative translation, interpretation. It is the dis-ease, the fact that we cannot come to rest at any point on the seesaw. But normally we don't see that because we're so busy running up and down the seesaw. And of course, some of us are wise enough to figure out, well, now wait a minute, right in the middle there, that's what I want, right? In American English, we call it our comfort zone, right? So for example, at work, we don't want too much stress or anxiety, of course, but we don't want to be bored either. So we would like a job that is fulfilling, satisfying. Hopefully the boss loves us and all the workers respect us, and of course we should get all the good jobs. And usually we end up causing stress for those around us as a result. But anyway, we figure if we can get kind of in the middle, right? Remember how you used to do that? I know I did. You put one foot on this side in the middle, one foot on this side. That's pretty neat, right? But of course, it doesn't take long for us if we look right under our feet to realize that that itself is just part of the dis-ease. That itself is not true stability. We cannot really come to rest in the middle because the middle itself is moving. The middle itself does not stay. Even if we manage, for example, to find that perfect medium, the boss loves us and all the workers and everything, something inevitably comes from out of the blue and knocks that away. So perhaps the most important thing for anyone, and I would say on any genuine spiritual path, this is not just about Buddhism. A few weekends ago I did something in Brussels on Zen and Eckhart, the Dominican priest. And it was a nice weekend because it became obvious as the weekend went on that we were clearly talking from two very different religious dimensions, the Catholic mystic Meister Eckhart and Zen. We were talking about two very, very different religious traditions, and we weren't trying to mix them up and, say it's all the same. No, these are two, the Judeo-Christian tradition and the Buddhist tradition coming in some sense out of Hinduism. Very, very different culture, very, very different history, very, very different. And yet, we could see very clearly where they were going and that at their depths there was something very, very profound here. And of course, one of the things that Meister Eckhart and I think any genuine Christian spiritual tradition, and not just Christian, makes clear is unless we see the fundamental dis-ease of existence, we don't go on the religious quest to begin with. If we're still fooling ourselves, if we're still deluding ourselves, if we're still locked into the seesaw, we're not really looking for a spiritual quest. We're looking maybe to find some way of staying in the middle, which eventually we find, of course, is not possible. Once again, the fundamental beginning, I would say, on any genuine spiritual quest, the genuine beginning of any spiritual quest is to see that the entire complex of our existence, not just the bad or the boring, the entire complex is inherently, that means by its very nature, inherently unstable. We cannot come completely, fully to rest in ordinary human existence. And deep down, I think we all know that. But we don't know what to do. We ordinarily don't even consider the possibility that we can leap off the seesaw. No, we've been riding it so long, all our life, and some of us have become so good at it that we don't realize that we can actually just leap off. I would say that's the beginning of real spiritual practice. So once again, it's extremely important to see through the entire complex, not just look, oh yeah, if I could just get rid of the bad, right? Get rid of my boss and I'll be happy, right? I think we're mature enough to see through that, right? If that boss goes away, we usually get another one. Maybe he's better, maybe he's not. The boss is not the ultimate problem, right? So, once again, it's extremely important in any spiritual quest first to see that the entire complex is the problem, not just the bad or the evil or something like that. The entire complex. When Buddhism talks about the first noble truth, that dis-ease, all conditioned existence, which means the whole seesaw, is in a state of dis-ease. It's not saying everything is suffering, as sometimes it translates. No, on that seesaw there is great joy, there is great pleasure. That's all there. No denying it, absolutely. But if you look directly at your own happiness, your own joy, you find out how easily it becomes the seeds of our own suffering. Right? When we're suffering, when we're in pain, when we don't have what we want, or when we're in a state that we don't want to be in, the suffering is pretty obvious, right? It's immediate, it's felt. But even in our deepest joy or happiness, right there are the seeds of our own dis-ease. Why? Well, look what happens when we're very, very happy. For a moment, it's wonderful, but we often become a little too happy about our happiness, don't we? The happiness itself is not really a problem. It's the clinging that comes afterwards. I'm not as happy as I used to be. I'm not as fulfilled as I think I should be. And we actually become diseased, in dis-ease, in distress, because we're not as happy as we think or imagine we should be. It's amazing what the ego can do on the seesaw. So once again, it's not saying everything is suffering. It's saying that at the bottom of human experience is inherently, by its very nature, unstable. We cannot come fully to rest. So even our moments of happiness contain an element of uncertainty. Either we grasp onto that happiness and thus destroy it in the process, or we actually become anxious about losing it, right? But what happens if I'm not always like this, right? We can actually destroy our happiness the very moment that we gain it, or at least that we cling on to it. So once again, Buddhism is not saying it's all suffering. It's saying at the bottom, the entire complex, not just the bad side, the entire complex of human existence is inherently unstable. The very nature of the seesaw, so to speak, that's the way it works. We cannot come to rest on the seesaw. Not at this end, that end, not in the middle. Let me make it even more concrete, okay? So far, so good. Nothing mysterious or esoteric here, right? Okay. Let's look at the experience of boredom for a moment, okay? What is boredom? What is the actual experience of boredom? Has anyone here been bored? Put it the other way. Has anyone here never been bored? Okay, I got a capital one. There is no such thing as bored. Do you realize that? Do you realize how radical that is? For any genuine Buddhist, there could never be boredom. Of course, there could never be anxiety or stress either, but that's another thing. There is no such thing as boredom. There is no, your English is okay, not a problem with language. There is no such thing as boredom. The next time you experience boredom, let that boredom be your teacher at the moment. See where that boredom comes from. It's very interesting. What is boredom? Boredom is only possible for the ego. Unless you have a self which expects or anticipates things to be a certain way, you can't be bored. Boredom is only possible when we have projected, maybe we're not even fully conscious of it, but we have projected things should be a certain way. This movie should be a certain way, and it's not. Boring. This person should be a certain way, but he does not meet my expectations. Boring. Right? I recently ran across a quote by Chesterton who said, actually the same thing, but he didn't mean it. He said, there's no such thing as boredom, only boring people. He was making a very interesting, sarcastic social comment, right? But of course, in Buddhism, there's no such thing as boredom. There are no boring people either. There is no such thing as boredom. If you experience boredom, it's because you have the delusion of a self or an ego. You have created an illusion, and you're living it out, and you're suffering. Once again, the same thing is true for stress or anxiety and all the other diseased emotions that we have. There is no such thing. You might think, well, what about Zazen? I mean, that's about as boring as it gets sometimes. Zazen can never be boring. Nothing can ever be boring. But Zazen is the most extreme case. In genuine Zazen, the whole universe is coming to form at every moment, completely fresh. At every moment, the whole world is being born anew. Would you tell me how that can be boring? Huh? How can that be boring? It can't. Maybe Chesterton was right when he said only people are boring. It can't. There is no such thing as boredom. Boredom is only possible when we posit a self and we set up a certain expectation and it is not that. Without that, there is no boredom. On the seesaw, boredom is impossible to alleviate, to get rid of. If you leap off the seesaw, boredom itself is impossible. Please be careful. This does not mean that people who are awakened to the truth, are enlightened, don't feel anything, right? Looking at it from the outside, well, that's right, they don't feel stress, they don't feel boredom, well, they don't feel anything. I don't like this. No. On the contrary, being, just another way of saying being awake, being free of self, being actually free of ego, realizing that truth jumping off the seesaw. There is no such thing. But that doesn't mean you don't have emotions or feelings. On the contrary, the emotion then is completely pure. The emotion then is completely pure. That's why there can't be boredom, which is tainted by ego, or stress or anxiety, which is also tainted by ego. Can you, maybe it's still not clear to you, but I'll now show to you that every one of you already understands exactly what I'm talking about. Because you are not a self. There is no such thing. What's the difference between pure emotion and emotion tainted by ego? Every one of you knows. Every one of you knows that. Maybe you never thought it through before. Anybody here ever fall in love? Okay, anybody here never fell in love with anything? Or anyone? Okay, again, cast the body. Okay. The experience of falling in love is perhaps the most wonderful human experience between people as possible. It's so wonderful, right? You don't even have to speak. You just look in the eyes of the other, and they're looking in the eyes of you. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Love, in a sense, is the non-duality of the seesaw. Experience between two people. You can still be the same asshole with other people. That's the problem with love. It may be real good with these two, but then it doesn't work with everything, does it? Well, very simply, we can say Buddhist awakening is being that way with everything, because the root of self is let go. Once again, the experience of love itself, we can say, is selfless. You lose yourself and find yourself in another. Isn't that what love is? You lose yourself, and then you find yourself anew in the other, and it's wonderful. Okay, is this mysterious? Everybody knows what I'm talking about? Okay. Then what happens? When the ego kicks in, then that wondrous thing turns into jealousy, possessiveness. You end up destroying the thing that you love. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Does anybody not know what I'm talking about? Okay. You already know, in a sense, intuitively, exactly what I'm talking about. You know that experience, and it's not just with another person, of course, it's with music, it could be just about anything. And you also know what happens when the ego, in a sense, kicks in. There's a temporary lull, a temporary transcendence of the ego. That's a fact. It happens all the time because there is no such thing. It's not real. But the complex comes back, and then possessiveness, jealousy, right? It's mine. What is it? My little precious. That's a great ending. He actually leapt into the flames for that, right? He actually killed himself because he wanted it so much. My little precious. It's a nice ending. Okay, it's even in Lord of the Rings. Okay, this is obvious. We all know, in some sense, exactly what, and again, this is what I'm talking about. This is what Buddhism has been talking about for the last 2,500 years, okay? There's nothing wrong with that pure experience of love. We all know it's the most confirming, selfless, and yet self-fulfilling, truly self-fulfilling experience of all. It's wonderful. And we also know what happens when the ego kicks in. So we already know, in some sense, exactly what the problem is and what needs to be done. Love is not the problem, right? It's the clinging of the ego that comes after it. That's the problem. That's where all the shit comes from, right? It's obvious. And we can talk about it with any experience you would like, any emotion you would like. It's just as clear. So, as I said, awakened people, people without ego, without self, far from being unemotional or having no emotions, have pure emotions. They don't cling, they don't strangle the thing that they love, though, right? You see the fundamental difference? The experience, the pure experience, is just what it is. It's neither good nor bad. But once the ego corrupts it, clings to it, well, we all know what happens. Let's go back for a moment to the very concrete experience of boredom. So, as I said again, there's no such thing as boredom. Isn't that a great excuse for a boring lecture? I kind of got myself covered here. If you're feeling it now. But if you're fortunate enough to actually experience boredom, one thing you can do, one very interesting way of Zen practice is if you can realize that emotion as it arises, that can be your teacher. That can be your teacher. You can dissolve it, or you can also see through it, or you can also work with it. But what do we normally do? We normally only see the boredom after it has already arisen, right? It's already become an emotion and a thought. Oh, it's so boring. And then what do? We justify it, we rationalize it, and it all makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Whether it's the bus system in Holland, or your boss, or your teacher, or your wife, or whatever, you know, right? They are so boring. Or they are so, whatever it may be. If you're serious about your Zen practice, you can actually see, as your sitting settles, you can actually see the emotion arising, whether it be anxiety, boredom, whatever. That's when you have to see it. If you can see it in the moment of its arising, then you don't become enslaved by it, as we normally do. Once it's already turned into, right, we actually think we create our thoughts, but you know, it doesn't take a psychoanalyst to show us that there's a lot more going on there. But to actually be able to see clearly the arising, and again in Buddhism, a thought or an emotion, they're not fundamentally different. A thought or an emotion as it arises. This takes some time and some subtlety in your practice, but it is entirely possible. Not when it has already taken on form and then we go on justifying it, right? Being enslaved by it, but actually to see it as it arises. That means, once again, that we can let it go. That also means that we can respond to it. Because that emotion may show, for example, I need to talk to that person. Or maybe even something like, I need to quit my job. It doesn't mean, oh, I never do anything. I just sit there and realize, oh yeah, it's all wonderful. No. A response may be necessary, but a response from the source itself, not from your own ego relation, what we normally do, right? Oh yeah, he's the problem. If I can only get rid of that stuff. It just usually creates more problems. So to actually see the source of the emotion arising in you, this can be very, very valuable, you can imagine. And again, that doesn't mean that you can never do anything about the situation. If you can purely experience that, it becomes clear. For example, I need to quit my job. Or I need to tell my boss that he's doing something really wrong. That's possible. That's right. But not from out of your own ego relation, you see what I mean? But out of, in a sense, the words I use, out of the source itself. This takes some time, some patience, and some discipline, some practice. But it is entirely possible. And it is one way of doing Zen practice. To actually experience the arising of the thought or emotion, whatever it may be. And then to be able to, in a sense, be with it right there. Then once again, you're able to let it go. You're also able, if necessary, to respond in, you know, in the world of, for example, human relations. So I think I've made it clear. Being free of self does not mean that you don't feel it. It means that you don't have the feeling of the ego conflict, those emotions. But you have very, very pure emotions. I would go so far as to say no one cares more than a Buddha or an awakened person. No one cares more than a Buddha or an awakened person. But they don't cling. That's the difference, you see? they don't strangle that which they care about. It's like, just like in the sutras, it uses the metaphor of a parent caring for their child. When the child is sick, the parent is sick. Not really sick, the child is sick, not the parent, but as anyone, any parent knows, the parent is sick as well, sick with the suffering of the child. And the parent will not be well until the child is well. Well, that's love. Well, that's the same thing with a Buddha. A Buddha freely shares the suffering of those around him. Not just to suffer with them, but to show them that at bottom, they are free of suffering because they are free of self. That's really being helpful. That's being helpful in a Buddhist sense. It may be helpful to give a loaf of bread or to give therapy. All of that is, of course, extremely helpful. But from the Buddhist perspective, the most helpful thing is to, by, you may not even have to talk, but simply being in the presence of another person. For example, someone who is dying. And sharing with them the fact that it's okay. That it's okay. You can let go. And being like that with another person, especially someone who is dying, can be very, very helpful. Because often people, when they're dying, they come to this. They come to some realization of no self natural. It's a shame to wait right until the end of life. But some people, even at the end of life, are not able to let go. So just to be in the presence of someone, for example, who is dying, and to actually be without self with them, you don't even have to talk, can be very, very helpful. So I think we've already made a couple of points clear, right? The seesaw, we're not talking about the bad, right? We're the boss. We're talking about the entire complex. That must be grasped as one, then religious practice can begin. If you're still pointing at this or that, you can't begin religious practice. If you're going to grasp this or that, like a thought or emotion, you've got to grab it at the source. Then you can work. But if you're simply doing it as something that's already arisen as a thought or a feeling of the ego, it's endless, right? You're simply going back and forth on the seesaw. So as radical as it seems, we can say practice really begins by leaping off the seesaw. Well, how do you leap off the seesaw? You just leap off the seesaw. The same thing with saying, how do you wake up? Or as a matter of fact, the other day in Eindhoven, it was an interesting question. This woman wanted to get awakened, right? She wanted to get enlightened, but she found when she sat, she kept falling asleep. Common problem, right? So I asked her, how do you fall asleep? The ego can't fall asleep, you know. The ego can't do it. But do you think you can fall asleep right now? Why can't you do it? Why do we use the English, I think we use the Dutch, to fall asleep? To fall asleep. The ego has to be let go to fall asleep, doesn't it? And yet you do it every night, but you don't even realize what you're doing. You're letting go of your ego every night and you fall asleep. If you simply held on to it, you'd be awake all night, right? We've all done that, haven't we, huh? Right? How do you fall asleep? Am I talking about anything esoteric here? And do we do it every night? That is no self. But we don't normally realize what we're doing. And yet we do it. The point of Buddhism, of course, is in our practice, in our daily life, moment to moment, to actually realize that, yes, what it means to fall asleep, what it means to wake up. That's all it is. Nothing extraordinary. Nothing up in the clouds. No. It's actually coming home, being able to come to rest with what we really are. Not the complex of jumbled emotions of the ego, the hell that we create, the constant dis-ease of human existence. So far, so good. You want to stand up and stretch for a minute? Maybe your legs are sore. No? Just me. Please feel free if you want to stand up. Take your time. So I think it's clear what the problem is, that it must be grasped as a whole, and then the possibility through practice, and again, Zazen is one superb way, one excellent way to do it, but not the only way, to actually leap off the seesaw. The whole thing, not a little bit, but actually to leap off the seesaw. In a sense, there is no other way. There is no other way. And again, we saw what it actually means to be like that. It doesn't mean to be lifeless, cold, sterile, right? At all. It means to feel those emotions with total purity, the total depth of our human emotions, without mixing it up with ego conflicts. Far from being cold or unemotional, I would say, as I did, there's no one more caring, there's no greater warmth than being without self. It's precisely ego that creates all the cold. Being without self is the source of genuine human warmth, whether child and parent or loved one or friend. Being without self, to whatever extent it's realized. Needless to say, Buddhism is talking about the full and final letting go of the whole complex. And yes, that's not only possible, but absolutely necessary. To let go of the illusions, in a sense, is a very delicate thing. We often get tripped. We trip over our own feet in our practice. In that sense, our practice must be very, very pure. There's a wonderful story. I haven't told any Zen stories yet. People might think, hey, maybe I'm in the wrong room. This is Zen Buddhism. I'll throw in a Zen story, okay? The record of Rinzai, or in Chinese, Linji, the father of Rinzai Zen. He was once showing a layman, I think he was a government official, the Zen of the meditation hall. And the government official said, what are the monks doing? Well, sitting in meditation, huh? And Linji Rinzai thought, he's a government official, so I guess you better give him the official answer, right? So he said, I'm making Buddhas out of this. Right? I'm making them to become Buddha. I'm making Buddhas out of them. The government official responded, oh, gold dust is precious, but in the eyes it blinds. A wonderful Chinese expression, right? Gold dust, what you use to make gold paintings and statues, right? dust from gold, extremely valuable, right? But if you get a little bit of it in your eye, right, it causes all kinds of problems. So once again, what are these monks doing? I'm making Buddhas out of it. Gold dust is precious, but in the eyes it blinds. And then of course Rinzai. It's one of the very few examples in the record of Rinzai where Rinzai actually gets vested. You know, usually almost every encounter with Rinzai ends with the master hits the monk. The master hits, I'm serious, the master hits the nun. The master slaps, the master yells, "Ka!" like that. But in this one, he actually gets shown up because he didn't realize the depth of this government official. And so his final response is, "Oh, I thought you were just an ordinary fellow." But do you see what he says? Yes. There's nothing more valuable than to realize the gold dust that we all carry around with us. But if it gets in the eyes, right? If it becomes a matter of our own self-conscious, right? If it becomes, if we try to bring some of it onto the seesaw, it gets a little confused. So the practice in that sense must be kept totally pure. Do not turn your practice into something. That's the way I put it. Your practice doesn't need to be painful. Doesn't need to be extremely pleasurable either. Don't fall into enlightened states. In a very radical way, Buddhism is not about having experiences. Buddhism is very much about the importance of actually experiencing something for oneself, not simply reading a philosophy. In that sense, experience is extremely important. And it's considered one of the revolutionary movements in Indian thought. Because Buddhism said, rather than rely on the Indian sacred text, the Vedas, what we do is we start with our actual experience. Okay? Which was, in a sense, very revolutionary 2,500 years ago. Right? Let's start with our actual experience. And he could do it, and he could show the whole path, the source of suffering and the way out of suffering. Through that, just with actual lived experience. So in that sense, experience is very important for Buddhism. But Buddhism is not interested in having experiences in that sense. You see what I mean? Having transcendent experiences, enlightenment experiences, and all that kind of stuff. If you really look deeply at Buddhism, it is not interested in that. Why? Because it's the extreme of the seesaw, that's all. It's still on the seesaw. If it's still an ego having experiences, however wondrous or momentarily freeing, you're still tied by your own self-delusion to the seesaw. So once again, Buddhism, in a very radical sense, is not about having experiences, any kind of experience, pleasurable. It's needless to say, it's not about the more the pain, the better, hurt when you sit. No, it's not saying that. But it's not saying these wonderful experiences that you have when you sit in sustained zazen. That's not what it's about either. There may be the extreme case of the seesaw effect, that's all. Buddhism is about, once and all, leaping off the entire complex. And in a way, that is all that zazen is about. True zazen. Simply being free of the entire seesaw. You see how stably we sit, right? This ain't no seesaw. Even when I get up, this does not get up. You see, that kind of stability, facing death, facing life, that's true stability. Not riding on the seesaw. About 10 after. Let me end with an American koan rather than a Chinese or Japanese one. Arkansas is a very poor state in the United States, one of the poorest. It's where former President Clinton came from, although I don't do political jokes. It's considered one of the poorest, it is actually one of the poorest states. It's in the center, a little bit to the south, okay? Arkansas. And it's considered rather backward. The people are not often very well educated. They raise hogs, pigs, and are farmers, so they're kind of looked down at by people on the East Coast and the West Coast, okay? They're hicks, country hicks. This is an actual story from about 180 years ago in the early years of the United States. They often had Christian revivals where they would have set up gigantic tents and people would come and preachers, different preachers would preach and they would try to save people. But they also, it's not so well known, but they also had great entertainment. They didn't just do that all day because the people would get tired of it. So other people would come in and not really tell jokes, but tell tales, play music, and entertain the people. Well, this, it's not clear exactly how it started, but this is the story known as the Arkansas Traveler, and modified, very minor for Zen purposes, but it's taken almost exactly as it is. There's a man, I'm from Philadelphia, I think you said that, huh? My Dutch is that good, right? Let's say it's a smart Philadelphia lawyer. They have a bad reputation. The Philadelphia lawyer, about 180 years ago, and he's in a horse and carriage, and he's on his way maybe to make some money to Conway, Arkansas, this little two-bit town in Arkansas. He gets a little lost. He sees a little boy, little country hick, in his little shack playing the fiddle on the front porch. So he says, "Hey, boy, come here." The boy comes over, "Yes, sir." He says, "Listen, I'm in a hurry. I want to get to Conway, Arkansas. Can you tell me how to get there as quickly as possible?" And the little boy kind of holds his little chin, and he looks up the road, and then he looks down the road. Then he looks up at the man and says, "Sir, you can't get there from here." Must be some way to get from here. I mean, maybe he has to go back a little bit, but there's got to be a way to get from here to there, right? But the boy said, "You can't get there." Okay, he's an idiot, the lawyer thinks. So let me make it. Can you tell me where this road goes to? The boy looks at the road again. He says, "It don't go nowhere. Every morning I get up and it's just sitting." Oh, finally, the guy has had enough. He says, "You must be the dumbest little kid I've ever met." The little kid says, "Maybe so, sir, but I'm not lost." We're all that smart Philadelphia lawyer trying to get there, preferably as quickly, as cheaply, and as easily as possible, aren't we, right? Therefore, making it impossible. Do you see that? Right? We're trying to get there as quickly, as cheaply, and as easily as possible. And therefore, of course, we never get there. The boy, I think you figured out who the Zen master is in this story, right? The little boy simply says, looking at the way the man is going from here, "You can't get there from here. You can't get there. Ego can't get enlightened. You can't get there. Only way is to just leap off. You can't get there. Not because it's so hard or it's so far away, but because it's so damn close." Yeah. And that's what the boy's saying. You can't get there from here. Just realize what's right under your feet. Well, he didn't get that, so he asked the second question. Okay. Where does this go to? At least if I follow this one, maybe I'll get there. Huh? It doesn't go anywhere. Nothing. I just traveled halfway around the world to be here. Do you realize that? From Kyoto, Japan, to Frankfurt, to Switzerland, to Austria, through Belgium, Holland. Eventually I'll go to Germany and then back to Japan. 51 days. Nowhere to go. I haven't moved an inch, you know. Paid a lot of money for the airline. No one has moved an inch. Do you realize that? Your whole life, we're so desperate to change our surroundings and our situation, right? You can't change anything, right? I mean, you can cut your hair, You can change your clothes. You can go somewhere where it's warmer. Or you can go to the moon now and bring your ego with you. In a very wonderful sense, nothing ever changes. When we realize that, then we can really be free. Until we realize that, we're just wrapped up in all the changes. Buddhism is not interested in that. You see why? Because it doesn't solve the problem. It just continues the problem. The illusion of self continues. Is it clear enough? So I guess there's no questions. We'll just end it all.